All right. I am Adam Palmer, for those of you who don't know me. And I'm just going to get into this because when I timed it this morning, it took an hour. So let's get started. Today's sermon is called You Don't Know What You Don't Know. This is actually a quote from John Mayer. Love that guy. And he's just talking about, he was using it to refer to his earlier periods of life where he was writing songs and thinking he had things figured out, and then you'd look up again and go, nope, got that wrong, and that process of not knowing what is still out there that you don't know. And so, first off, this is Jesus, or the image of Jesus that I think of when I think of Jesus. When I visited my grandmother, who lived in the country, African Methodist churches, this is the picture of Jesus I saw, next one, in their churches. When I went to their houses of family, this is the picture of Jesus I saw there. And even as I was researching this and going through different websites where they're having these more accurate depictions of Jesus, in the comments they were saying, no, it's okay. You know, Jesus wants us to see him, you know, as we see ourselves. He wants, you know, we're made in his image, so we need to see him through ourselves. In the comments, and there was obviously in a comment chain on the internet a lot of negativity associated with that. But especially being here in Japan and being married, I've learned a lot about what I don't know and how limited my perspective is based on where I come from. I was raised in the West. I was raised in America. And the longer that I'm here, the longer I study. I'm in seminary right now at Dallas Theological Seminary online. And the longer I'm in that and hear about professors who have spent 15 years in Poland and these different things, I realize that I may actually be at a disadvantage being from America when it comes to understanding the culture that Jesus grew up in, because he didn't grow up in America. He grew up in the Middle East. And according to the most recent forensic evidence, this is what Jesus probably would have looked like. Obviously, we can't know for sure, but knowing that he's from the Middle East, blonde hair, blue eyes is probably not the case. Probably wasn't African. We can safely assume that the image, that even now, if you ask me, knowing this, what does Jesus look like? If I think about it in my head, that first picture comes up. It's been in me for my whole life. And we have this beautiful opportunity through living in Japan to unlearn some of the things that we know and open up a whole new understanding of who Jesus was. The Bible in itself is full of culture. All these letters written to different cities, different places, it's culture, it's contextual. And it goes beyond just figuring out what people did. It goes much deeper into how they thought. And that's what I hope to talk about today. First, a recap. I know some of you are new. This whole year, we've been going through Colossians, kind of on and off with different pastors, but generally been going through the book of Colossians. And the church in Colossae was a relatively new church at the time this letter was written. It was started by a man named Epaphras, who had been converted by Paul, and then he moved to Colossae and started a church. And as any church, especially a young church, goes, they started to have people come in and say, well, yes, we're Christians, but also do this. Talking about ceremonialism, Christ was becoming less than the Son of God. He was becoming a teacher. He was becoming different things. There's Christ, but there's also this. There's Gnosticism, this reliance on human knowledge and human tradition. All these different things were coming into the church. And this is Paul from prison, writing this letter saying, well, no, let's backtrack here. Don't get confused. This is what Christianity is about. This is what Jesus taught. So if you would read with me Colossians 4, 2 through 6, I believe it is. And we just read the whole thing together, if you don't mind. Devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful. And pray for us, too, that God may open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains. Pray that I may proclaim it clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders, making the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. So, good translation. I like it. And I was going through and looking at the Greek, trying to, I don't speak Greek, I barely study Greek, but looking back at the way they meant these words, it was amazing how, even though it's a good translation, it was missing part of the original idea. So then I found this translation. Next slide. Nope, one more, sorry. Go back. This one, yes. This one changes words here and there, but it's actually closer to what the understanding would have been in Greek. Continue steadfastly in prayer, being watchful in it with thanksgiving. At the same time, pray also for us that God may open the door to us, a door for the word. Whew. To declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison, that I may make it clear, which is how I ought to speak. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. And there are a few words in there that change between the translations, but when you go back to the beginning, it recasts the entire verse almost. The first one being, next slide, please. Next one. The first one being logos. The second translation said the word, Jesus. You say proclaiming our message, all of a sudden it's our message. No, the original was saying proclaiming Jesus. Next is the best use. You know, make use of every opportunity. There was this idea, it's the same word they use for ransom, the time that we have. Ransom back the time. You have to fight, we have to pay for it and take it back. Next was towards. It said in the first one, I can't remember what it said in the first one, be wise how you interact with outsiders, basically. And this is saying, no. It's saying towards outsiders. It's the same word for the destination of something. So that changes slightly. And then towards outsiders, literally meaning out, those who are not within. And the biggest one that I want to focus on for now is that Greek word, which I forgot. No, mysterion. I don't know how to read Greek, as close as I can get. But this mystery is not something that is undiscerned by men themselves. It's something that can only be understood through divine revelation. And so when you talk about declaring the mystery of Christ, it's not saying put together the right words, say the right things. It's saying God has to open the door. This is the focus of this entire passage is about opening the door, because only God can open that door. And even in that, I don't know how it affected some of you, but me growing up in my background, I was always had this impression of if I can say the right words, have the right apologetics, put together the right Romans road, it's a guarantee almost. And having been here for 2 years and done that and seen them look at me and go, cool. And nothing changed. It's not on me. So the first thing to remember through all of this is that God opens the door, not our wisdom, not our tradition, not our apologetics. First and foremost in all of this, God has to open the door. Okay. So now we get into the idea of Jesus not being from the West and the opportunity that we have here in Japan to understand a culture which in many ways is more like the culture Jesus would have grown up in. First is this Eastern idea of honor and shame. We talk about the West being a guilt culture and Japan and many Eastern cultures being an honor or shame thing. I was doing a lot of research on this, and basically honor and shame were pivotal values during the first century. And honor was a combination of two things: the value of a person in their own eyes and the value of a person in the eyes of their social group. Both of these played a key role in honor. And so Christianity, from the start, just throws that aside. You look at Philippians. First, in Philippians 2, Jesus made himself nothing. Paul saw himself as nothing. So already we have half of that honor taken away. How I see myself as nothing. And in the next chapter, you hear Paul talking about all the worldly things. I memorized this before. I forgot it now. He talks about everything that all his earthly values he puts aside for Christ, being born in the tribe of Benjamin, going to the right schools, as far as zeal, perfect in the law, you know, persecuting Christians, all these things that the culture would have said, yes, that's honorable. You've earned your honor. He's saying it means nothing. And if you talk right now to Japanese students, I teach many Japanese classes and have middle schoolers who are freaking out about this test they take at the end of middle school and determines which high school they go to. The system is slightly changing, but in general, this test determines which high school you go to, which determines which college you go to, which determines which job opportunities you have. So it is not a matter of this Western idea of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, I stood on my own two feet. A lot of this is determined based on where you were born, what school you went to. All of these things play into your future and who you are, essentially, in the eyes of society. And Paul, who had won, essentially, he won at life at that point. He had all the advantages that all people would look at him and go, yes, this guy, I'm going to follow on this path. He's done it. He meets Christ and says, I did what you're aspiring to. I did what culture has taught you is an incredible thing to do, and I consider it nothing. Not some outsider saying this, coming in and saying society is wrong. Paul from the inside of this shame culture saying, I want honor in your eyes, and I consider it nothing. Understanding it through that lens is incredible to reread some of these letters and just how vehement he was about these things. And this culture, people who were shameless were considered dishonorable. And such persons were denied normal social courtesies. It wasn't a matter of being independent. You were denied access to society in many ways. And I've only been here 2 years, so I can't speak with much authority on Japanese culture, but I think you can venture to say that there's a strong in-group, out-group dynamic going on here, and it's very important to be in the group. The next one, next ideal of Japanese culture along with this, the in-prison part. That's what I meant to accent earlier, the in-prison part. For Paul to even say he's in prison after all the things he had, this is a shameful thing. For him to say this, to say it boldly, is completely countercultural, completely against the idea of hiding what is wrong, putting forth your best face. For him to say this proudly and be shameless in this was incredibly countercultural. And while there's almost a reverence for standing on your own two feet, admitting you're wrong in the West, you know, I admit I was wrong, I made a mistake. That's not how it works here. It's very, very opposite of that. Just look at the tragedy in Fukushima and see if it's good to admit that you made a mistake and say that I've done something shameful, or even admit that something's wrong with you. As much honor and shame, as much value as they place in the honor and how people see you, to admit these things was crazy. The next thing, being individualism versus collectivism. In the West, in the Western mind, we say with pride, you know, I'm my own man, my own opinions, stand on my own two feet. In Jesus' culture, and the same kind of thing in Japanese culture, that's not a value. That means you've separated yourself from the circle. You're outside now. Group bonding and social cohesion were valued over the individual. And an aspect of love in that culture was the refusal to do what will bring harm to your kin and what would harm yourself, because you are part of that group. You are your group. And here comes Christianity teaching that it's okay to break family ties rather than give up your faith. And this would have been not just different or strange, but radical and outlandish in a culture where you are defined by your family and your social circle. And it was much bigger than giving up material goods. It wasn't just, I'm going to follow Christ and I might be poor for a while. You were turning your back on so many things that you've been raised to value above all else. For a guy who was outside. The longer you're here, I know that when I look back on what I've said here 10 years from now, being here that much longer, it will make so much more sense. But just opening your eyes to the fact that Jesus grew up in the Middle East, not in the West, not as far in the East as Japan, but this weird mixing of Roman Western culture and Greek Eastern culture. It's pretty cool to reread the Bible through this lens. Anywho. All right. So the next thing, next slide, is to make it clear. This is a very small word, but very important. When I first got here, I was asked to teach a Bible study at my wife's college, Rosh Majoka Queen University. And I was fresh out of, you know, Christian schools my whole life, went to a Christian university, was applying to grad school to learn more about the Bible. I was like, all right, I can do this thing. So I went there and borrowed a story from Pastor Chris that he shared a long time ago. He said something about a woman who had stolen bread and got caught. And she went to the courts, and the judge said, you've been found guilty. And she said, I can't pay. And the judge pulls out the money and pays the fine. It's this really cool story of, you know, I owed something, Jesus paid the price. And then you take that to the next level of what would you do if it wasn't just $10 for bread, it was you owed your life for what you've done. And the judge says you're guilty. And then Jesus comes in and says, I'll die in his place. And in my mind, this is a very beautiful metaphor. Like, I like the analogy, and I said that through the translator, and they went, No reaction, it's a good point, nothing. And later I came to realize, different culture, there's an emphasis on clean versus dirty. Like, before I came and read up on traditions, and the top of your head is clean in this culture, and you don't show the bottom of your feet because they're dirty. Like, these weird ideas, and good spirits in, bad spirits out every year, and you take your shoes off in the house. There's this emphasis on clean versus dirty. So to make my message more clear to people who didn't grow up the way I grew up, it was more effective to use this metaphor from their culture, from their understanding. And I believe that when you're dealing with a place like Colossae, which at the time this letter was written was falling off, but before then was a huge center for commerce. So hundreds of people were coming through in different ideas, different religions, different philosophies. And you have this mix of all this. So when you write a letter to people dealing with this, it's important to be clear, not from your end, but communication is what they understand. So you can't go, it makes sense to me. Here we go. You have to think about what makes sense to them. And this takes a very intentional thing and gives you a great opportunity here in Japan to look at someone and say something that you think makes all the sense in the world and see them go, and it won't. It doesn't work sometimes. All right. Next thing. I think one of the most telling things about Japanese culture that also applies to the Middle Eastern culture through my research is that the word for different and the word for wrong are the same word. It's a very telling thing about how traditional the society is. Tradition is valued above anything. And so because of that, there's this intrinsic incompatibility between Christianity and classical values. Because Christianity, not only morally and in all these different ways, contradicted the culture. They're not saying the Roman gods we've had for years add Jesus to them. They're saying forget all these years of tradition and trust this new thing. And As you can see here around you, new things are not exactly embraced, especially from outsiders. And Christianity, likewise, was not playing off of people's natural desires. You had these pagan cults coming in with temple prostitutes. We're going to have drunken parties, all these things that relate to the carnal values of man. So it's more appealing. And here comes Christianity saying, no, we're going to deny that. We're going to focus on the next world and more important things. So there was nothing intrinsic to it to make it appealing if you're just looking at what I want to do. And so it was deeply against both the Western ideas from the Romans and the Greek traditions from the East. And pretty much they're looking in the face of both of these cultures, both of these long-standing traditions, and saying, no, we have something different. And so next. This is a map of Christianity, starting way back in the beginning, and then it's the Great Schism, and then you have Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodox, and then way at the top, you have Protestants, who many of us, our denomination stems from this. And especially for me, being Baptist, Protestant, which at the root of it all starts from a guy saying, I'm challenging tradition. At the foundation of many of our theological backgrounds is a natural questioning of tradition. It's okay. You can ask questions. You can do the research, find out for yourself. But in this culture, that wasn't valued. You value tradition. This is how we've done it. This is how it's always been. Why would you question that? So it's, again, a disadvantage, in a way, to have grown up the way I grew up. Can't speak for all of you. As the saying goes in Japan, the nail that stands out is hammered down. It's not good to stand out, not good to question things. You follow tradition. And essentially, because of that, either you're in or you're out. Next slide, please. The next one here. It says walk towards outsiders. This is one of those very different things from some of the translations you get. It says walk in wisdom toward. As I said, this is the destination. Our goal is to take Christ to outsiders. It's not a, we'll stay within our group, you know, we'll do this. Our objective is to go. Our calling is to go out. And now let's get to the application process here. First question I want to ask is, are you making the best use of the time here? Some of you have just gotten here. Some of you have been here for a while. And the question, next slide, please. There we go, all right. Are you making the best use of your time here? This is one of those questions I don't want to put forward because I don't want to think about it for myself. I'm not making the best use of my time here. And it talks about this time being redeemed. Not time is money and it's my resource and I'll, you know, I'll use it as I feel. No, it's talking about a mandate, a requirement to redeem this time, to make it something, to make use of this incredible opportunity that we have on both sides of it. I don't mean to just emphasize those who come from abroad. Just as much as we can understand more about Christ and the Bible through the Eastern mind, the opposite is true as well. It's very important, and this is an incredible opportunity we have here to meld all kinds of different cultures and not erase our image, but make a more complete image of who this person who is not, who transcends culture. We can understand these parts and somehow get a much fuller understanding. The next question here is, are we being gracious? The word here, gracious and seasoned with salt, this salt is talking about wit. If you read some of Jesus' interactions with people, he was incredibly sarcastic in some situations. He was smart. He knew the culture. He knew how to say things that were effective for that person. I wish we could spend 30 minutes just going through the conversation with the woman at the well, the Samaritan. And I tend to read it naturally with these thous and dost. It seems very lofty and very pomp and circumstance-y. But the reality of it is that they're going back and forth sarcastically. She's going, are you better than Jacob? And he's like, no. He's saying he is better than Jacob. Go back and read it when you get the chance. John 4, read it. He knew what to say. He knew how to say. He knew to say, you know, where's your husband? And she goes, I don't have one. He goes, yeah, you don't have one. Well, technically you had five, but now you're like, it was this exchange, this wit. And salt is, when overdone, is too much. It's tart. It's sharp in a way, I guess. So grace and salt, knowing the culture well enough to interact on that level. When Lisbeth's dad came to visit, he was very excited to learn a Japanese pun, steki steki, which some of you don't get because you don't know the culture. This is obviously not a fault of yours, but when it talks about seasoned with salt, it talks about knowing these little things, getting into the culture so you understand. Steki steki is beautiful and steak put together. So there's your little Japanese pun for the day. Jesus knew the culture. He sees in this conversation with a conscious understanding of who they were and a wit on a personal level. And it's easy to sit somewhere else and formulate what you're going to say when you talk to somebody. It's much more difficult to get to know that person, to get to know that person's culture and how they think, and then talk to them. Not at them, but to them. And we have, again, an incredible opportunity here in Japan to understand something that we couldn't understand in our home countries, or on the other side, couldn't understand without talking to people from a different place. The next question here. Go to the next one. It did. Are you living like it's your choice to make? One of the most painful paragraphs I read in my research was the idea of what freedom meant in the Mediterranean world. Freedom was understood to be freedom from one master to serve another one. There was not autonomy. There was not, I'm free from him and I'm my own man. It was freedom from this to choose to be a slave to this. When the Bible speaks of slavery to sin and slavery to the cross, these aren't two of three options. It's two options. And in that culture, they understood that very clearly. So you are free from Christ, free from sin, but slave to Christ. So this isn't a choice. We're not autonomous, and I'll use, if I feel that it's a good idea, I'll use the time I have here to serve Christ as well. It's not a choice. It's not freedom. When we say we're free in Christ, we are free to be the slave of Christ. Even saying it doesn't make sense, but that is the way it was understood. That's what they heard, and it's important that we don't read it in this individualistic Western mindset. That is what they understood. You need to understand it through that lens. All right, to end it, I've forgotten to do this before, to the cross. If you get a chance to do more research on it, I spent many hours just reading about how Jesus would have been seen to that culture. And it's incredible to think that I see it as suffering for me, so it's honorable. You know, the martyr's life was a life of honor. If you look at that culture, Jesus was not to them a hero going up, owning up under suffering. From the beginning, he was born in the wrong place. Can anything good come from Nazareth? When he spoke with authority, it was amazing because he shouldn't have had that authority. He didn't have the background of someone like Paul. He's speaking with authority in the same way as the people who had the authority of the culture, who had studied in the right places, knew the right things, had the right relationships. But here comes this guy from Nazareth, and he speaks in such a way that it's moving people. The people who should have the authority are falling in front of him and failing before his grasp of the word and his, I don't even know how to explain what it would have meant. In their heads, to the Pharisees, it wasn't, I've lost this battle, this argument. It's, I've lost the authority. He's taken something that the culture has given me, and now they're not responding to that. And so we have this guy who is saying to a well-established culture, no, this is the new way. This is how it should be. These things that you value, these things you built your life around, they mean nothing compared to this, compared to what I have to offer. And when you look at a traditional culture, much more like Japan than America, that's not something desirable. I look at the outsider and the person, if he argues himself, well, I respect that. I listen, I want to hear him out. That's not how it worked in his world. There was protocol. When he talked to the Pharisees, there was supposed to be a certain way that he interacted as them being his superior. He was supposed to say certain things, and he didn't say those things. He was not supposed to even engage with the Samaritan woman, but he did. So he's doing these things that are shameful to this culture, that are very countercultural, and yet people are responding to this. Secondly, Jesus was a terrible marketer. He had 5,000 people following him, and by the end, crowds are gone. He wasn't trying to feed people what they wanted to hear. In this culture, he was alienating himself. He was an outsider. And this isn't, again, it's not the same understanding that I grew up with as the rebel, almost the glorification of the guy who stands alone. That is not remotely desired in Jesus' day. And yet, he's calling people to do that. He's calling people to turn away, to essentially hate their family compared to how much they love him. This is not a desirable thing in any way. Something that resonates with me, this idea of having that calling and going after it. That was not the effect it would have had when he said these things back then. So he dies almost alone. Very few of the people who would have been there or should have been there were there. And even beyond that, just this small fact as I was reading more about it, he was buried in a tomb by himself. Joseph of Arimathea bought a brand new tomb and put him in it, in a culture where the honorable thing is to be buried with your family. We see the reverence in funerals and such here in Japan. You go back every year to your family grave. There's a family. You're part of this. This is part of your honor. And here he is buried alone in a brand new grave, miles from where his family, if they had a family plot, would have been. So through the end, just shame, all these things against the culture. And so as I got to the end of this, the only thought was, why didn't this die off? Why would this continue for 2,000 years and grow compared to other religions and other philosophies and traditions, which would perfectly play into what people should want, especially in that culture, even just people in general, based on carnal desires? Why wouldn't something that embraces do what you want, feel free, happiness is the, why would this religion, this, why would Christianity and these teachings persist? And the only answer that I've ever come across for that makes any sense is because of the mystery of Christ. Not dependent on human tradition or human knowledge, it is the mystery, which takes us right back to where the verse starts, with God opening the door. We have essentially an open door to a new world here in Japan, and with each person we meet who is of a different culture, a different tradition. But it's not enough to say the right words. It's not enough to, you can love somebody and sacrifice and give, and after 20 years of building a relationship so that obviously they'll listen to me now, they may not. It's not guaranteed. Paul realizes this, why he urges, pray that God will open the door for our message, because this message is not something they're going to want to accept of their own volition. This is not something that appeals to any part of how they've been taught their entire life. And the longer you're here, I'm sure you'll understand how contrary Christianity is to not just Eastern culture, to Western culture, to culture in general. And yet still, here we are, 2,000 years after Jesus died, here worshiping Jesus. Contrary to logic, contrary to culture, contrary to what makes sense. So my urgency to you, it's not the right word. Can't think of the word. I implore you to pray. Understand that we have a unique opportunity, but no matter how prepared you think you are, in this culture and in any culture, it is entirely dependent upon God opening a door so that this mystery that is not revealed through knowledge, but only through the Spirit, is able to continue and persist against all odds. It's not us, thank goodness. It's on Jesus and what he did. All right. Pray with me. Dear Lord, I thank you for this opportunity to come here and learn about parts of you that we could have lost had we stayed where we were, had we not come to a new place. And I pray that we will realize that it's not just wrong to depend on what we say and what we do, but it's, help us realize that ultimately it is about what you do and what you have enabled us to do through your power, not through our own, not through our wisdom. And I just pray that we'll take these opportunities to forge relationships and understand you in new lights. In Jesus' name, amen.